We're back. You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today, we're talking about episode 15 from season 4. It's the second part of the inauguration two-parter. It's called Inauguration Over There.
The story is by David Gerken and Gene Sperling, to whom we'll speak a little bit later. And the teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. This episode was directed by Leslie Linka Glatter.
And this episode is really a continuation of the last episode. The president is about to give his inaugural address, but first we go back in time. Whereas in part one, we started 6 days earlier. We're now closer to the inauguration itself. And the battle over the foreign policy section is still being hammered out. Danny Kincannon is digging further on his stories, although his reporting now involves getting Donna in trouble, and Charlie's still working on trying to get a Bible. That makes it sound like it's a less exciting episode than it actually was. I think this episode is great.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good episode. These two together are wonderful.
As Josh mentioned, we're going to be joined later by Gene Sperling, who has half of the story by credit in this episode, but he's also the director of the National Economic Council for both President Clinton and President Obama. This episode starts with Will asking Toby,
"You don't ever worry about the window breaking?"
Thus ensuring that before the end of Act 3, the window will break.
Indeed. Chekhov's window.
Exactly.
Yes, good episode for Toby's boss. Which leads me to shout out to our listener and now friend, Colin. Colin and Sarah. Colin having donated to the Radiotopia campaign and bought lunch with us.
We had lunch this past Sunday.
That was a good fun, and proving that he's a better guest than we were hosts, he brought us each a gift. He brought us each a signed Richard Schiff, and I think that money went to the, I almost said UCLA, the ACLU. He gave us each one of those Spalding signed by Richard in a lovely, like, commemorative plastic trophy container.
Yeah, I really was not expecting to get gifts at that lunch.
Yeah, neither was I. But I'm excited. So we each have one of those. I've got the left and you've got the right, I like to think.
We have those smooth pink balls.
Yes, very exciting. So yeah, in that Spalding scene, the first one, yeah, Richard, as Toby, talks about,
"It's always held up, that window. That window's a game day player."
And I thought that is like the highest compliment that Aaron Sorkin can pay, I guess, a person or an inanimate object. Yes. A game day player.
There's a detail I really like in this teaser, which is that at one point Will reads Toby the language that he has written for this foreign policy section, and he says,
"America stands today as the one truly indispensable nation, the strongest force and the proudest voice for peace, pluralism, and prosperity that the world has ever known."
And I felt like they had some nice continuity for Will's tendency towards alliteration.
Yes, very good.
As established by Arctic Radar.
"Your alliteration, happy, guardians of gridlock, protectors of privilege. I needed an avalanche of Advil."
It's just a little callback.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually several callbacks.
Calls back, go ahead.
There's several calls back in this episode to previously on The West Wing.
President calls back, yes.
That's one. And then also within this teaser, Will brings up a scene from season 1, episode 12, He Shall From Time to Time. He tells Toby, "I've heard about this story where you convinced the president not to use the phrase, the era of big government is over." And that's, we've witnessed that. We witnessed when that happened back in season 1.
Will mentions it and Toby says,
"There were maybe 4 people in the room when I had that conversation."
And I wanted Will to say, "Yeah, but it was highlighted on an episode of The West Wing."
There were only 3 people in that room, in fact. He says, "There were maybe 4 people in the room when I had that conversation, but in fact, there were only 3. It was Toby, Josh, and the president. And so I wonder who spilled the beans." Probably Josh.
I guess so.
Who does the president talk to? He just talks to Leo and Abby.
Yeah.
But I do like that Will says,
"Well, if I'd have been one of them, I'd have repeated it to everyone I met.
I would have told many, many people," basically what he says.
That's exactly right. And this is the scene during which Toby is chastising Will for having gotten into the president's head.
"Here, he was standing in the doorway.
The Dow plummets because of casual conversations with this man, but that's not the point."
What's the
and
point?
I watched this on the day of the single biggest point decline in the Dow, in the stock market, just a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking it's too bad that the State of the Union address isn't a weekly thing, so we could get a new and improved, updated version.
Sure. The Tweet of the Union. Could do the Tweet of the Union.
Yeah. There was this fake tweet that was going around that somebody had doctored about Trump.
I perpetuated it, even though I knew it wasn't real. I just thought it was funny. Yeah. But some people were mad at me. But
my favorite part was that it was that Dow Jones was misspelled in it.
J-O-A-N.
That was what really made it art.
That was funny. Here's one thing I liked about my own performance. Hmm. In this scene and elsewhere, I can see myself following one of my acting tenets, which is not to ever attempt to be likable. And Will is kind of sullen and maybe annoying, and he's not fun at all. Even Josh asks him out. He wants none of it. He rolls his eyes at Josh. He's not impressed at all with the idea that the president is haunted by it. You know, if there's not going to be any action, I don't care that you guys find it haunting or you're really moved by it, because we're not doing anything. I can see why. I mean, other things will happen story-wise, but some people are annoyed by Will, and that doesn't bother me. That's not a negative. And a lot of times in TV, the worst thing is to be unlikable, unless you are a villain, in which, of course, that's your job. And even so, you're supposed to be a villain in a way that's very charismatic, so that people really still kind of do like you. And, you know, The West Wing isn't that kind of show, but also that's not the kind of thing that ever even flipped through my mind.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if this character were written for you.
There you go. Oh yeah, it was.
Because those qualities feel like things that I would expect from you as well. The feeling of not being impressed by their good intentions alone.
Right. Well, that's where Jonathan Edwards and I really part ways.
Exactly. There you go. Callback.
Callback.
Just to continue on that point, I want to jump way, 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 way far ahead. I wouldn't have brought this up except that you've already now cracked open this egg.
Bring it.
One of my favorite moments that I think is most indicative of Will's character is, it's not very fun. The president, while trying to make a joke, says at the very end in the deputy swearing in ceremony,
"I don't know what to say."
That's what you want to hear from your new communications deputy?
He's like doing his thing. He's doing his, you know, genial
right.
presidential thing. And Will cuts him off and says, "I accept," with no sense of humor. and it's almost like Will is, or I think it is, Will is reacting to the text of what the president has said as opposed to the spirit of it. I think there's two things. It's not that I don't think that Will doesn't have a sense of humor, though he's not certainly like a really jolly guy. I think another part of his character is that he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder.
I think that's true.
I think we've seen it, you know, even in like in Arctic Radar, that's one of the things that I like so much in that Guardians of Gridlock scene. You know, the way he doesn't just sort of take the criticism from Richard Schiff and, I mean, from Toby and shrink away. He comes back and he retorts with force. And I think that he feels like he has something to prove a little bit. And most of the time that comes out in admirable ways, but I like that they carry that through, like you said, in ways that don't necessarily make him very likable. And that one little outburst is an example of that.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was fun to play also the weird mix of he finds himself daunted by certain situations, like meeting the president the first time or being deputized. He's got that same right. fog of not quite being able to figure out what's going on or being a beat behind. But it's also combined with sometimes even though he's out of his depths or dealing with people whose situations are way above him, he still can be aggressive to the point of sometimes jerkiness. It's a weird mix.
Yeah, it is. But it's a mix of things that I think ends up making sense really only because it's being, you know, melted together in the crucible of Joshua Molina.
Or Aaron Sorkin, really. But you're nice to say.
He's the chef okay. throwing the ingredients in.
It seems to me there's an atypical slow burn into the credits and into the sweep of the opening theme when Toby exits Will's office. And there isn't that usual kind of forward momentum. You know, either it's a funny line or it's an inspiring thing or there's a question. He just kind of walks out. Richard kind of gives almost like a look over his shoulder back to Will because it wasn't the most satisfying interaction. And then he kind of just walks towards his office. And it seems like that opening chord or note is longer than usual.
It's similar to what we heard in the episode where Josh was walking out of the Republican cloakroom.
And there's that weird, almost extra beat.
Yeah, but we were actually waiting for him to leave the room and there was sort of no action beyond that. Here, we get like a nice sort of visual moment of these two offices together. It's like a really beautifully framed thing. Of course, we know that that's the scene. But yeah, that little
it works well.
The isolation of the two characters, they're not on the same page. And I felt like they're using the composition of the frame metaphorically there. So I think that we've heard that kind of long lead up to the opening credits. It just felt a little different here
because
we're just looking at the scene. After we come back from the credits, CJ's in the briefing room, and then Danny follows her back, and CJ says, gives him a good day, sir.
Mm.
And he doesn't listen, and she tries again.
Good day to you, sir.
CJ.
I said, good day, sir.
Well, I believe that's a cinematic shout-out.
That's what I was wondering, if you thought that it was a shout-out. I feel like it has to be, right?
Willy Wonka.
Good day, sir!
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a great good day, sir, in Tootsie.
I said good day, sir.
Okay, and then again, we're back to this question that I had earlier. Is it Hutchinson or Hutchison? Danny says Hutchinson. CJ says Hutchison.
Look, all of it balanced out by the fact that Martin says cavalry correctly at some point in this episode.
Then he gets the plague, so my cavalry.
Because before he said Calvary?
Didn't we discuss that once?
I thought it was Leo who said Calvary.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong.
I feel like you needed an alley-oop on that, and I wasn't there for you.
That's okay. Sometimes I just get a blank response, and that's also okay, because even in life, I don't care about being likable. That's not entirely true.
Another acting moment of yours that I really enjoyed in this episode is seeing Will trying to put the cap on his pen one-handed.
Yeah, I didn't do that very deftly. I thought, really? Well, it's funny, because I fixated on that, too. Yes, and I was trying to think, what was so special about this take that we went with the one where I had such a hard time getting the cap onto the end? Or was it that? Because it's so real, because, of course, you know, most of the time we're not necessarily so adept at these things. Of course, I am, so... I was off. That's funny. They totally caught my eye too. I'm like, oh my God, for the love of God, just put that cap back on the end.
This is the scene where Josh and Toby and Will are going over the changes, the request, you know, can we change tens of billions to billions and billions? And Toby says no. And then as they're wrapping up, Will uncaps the pen, but is doing it one-handed because you were holding a folder or something. And then trying to like scoop the cap back on. It's a move that any ballpoint pen user, or really any pen user has probably attempted at some point. So
it was apparently that for me, it was a par three.
That's true. You had to dig for it.
Yeah.
I really liked that part. And then Josh wants to go to IOTA, a club in Arlington, which is a real place.
Oh.
It closed in September 2017.
No kidding.
It's no longer there.
I wonder why on earth they would use an actual place.
I don't know. Credibility?
I guess, but I don't know. It's funny. It's so strangely random, I think, when they decide to use, then you get Equatorial Kundu, but the club they go to is a real place. I don't know. It's just kind of funny.
Yeah, and they go to that club, and Jill Sobule is a real singer.
That's right.
She's in the club singing a real song of hers. It's a song called Heroes, and it's too bad that Will isn't there because it really feels like she's singing to him. The lyrics to the song are, "Why are all our heroes so imperfect? Why do they always bring me down? Why are all our heroes so imperfect? The statue in the park has lost his crown."
Then isn't there a recurring theme of people being drunk and depressed, these heroes?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a good song for contemporary times as well.
Louis C.K.
Jill Sobule is also the singer of I Kissed a Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she had that song Supermodel that was on the Clueless soundtrack.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, back inside the White House, I like this little exchange between the president and Leo.
Well, then, it was a dodged bullet.
No, sir. We didn't dodge nothing. It was aimed at. It was a shot across the bow. It was this guy giving it to
I liked how they carried the bullet metaphor throughout those different ideas. It was a dodged bullet. No, they hit what they aimed at. It was a shot across the bow.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they were able to move the imagery around without mixing metaphors.
I noticed in that CJ Danny scene that Claudia Jean is as big a fan of musical theater as you. In fact, maybe less of a fan, because you certainly would know who the Sharks and the Jets were.
She knows. I think she's not saying that she doesn't know, get the reference. I think she's saying she doesn't know necessarily who all the larger players
in
are
the, in it. Okay. I just wanted to say musical theater.
Well, because we know, in fact, earlier, she sings, boy, boy,
crazy. Oh, is that another episode?
That's in another episode. Remember, she says that to Sam.
Well, never mind, I guess. Fair enough.
Not only does she know the Jets and the Sharks, she knows their lyrics.
Being remade, by the way, by Spielberg.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, something about that.
Wow, I can get why the excitement in your voice is electric and contagious.
Yeah, well, hey, he's proven he's good with dinosaurs.
Yes.
Did you hear the Lin-Manuel Miranda episode of Song Exploder?
about his Maria.
Yeah.
No. I don't know how I haven't listened to it, because I've listened to a lot of Song Exploder, but I haven't yet. I'm embarrassed to admit.
Yeah, in his song, Almost Like Praying, West Side Story is part of the hook. It's really interesting how he references it and then flips it around.
All right. The listeners and I should go listen to that episode.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying I've been in contact with West Side Story enough.
Fair enough. How do you feel about Laurel and Hardy?
I've seen that movie. I remember watching that movie on WSBK Channel 56 in Massachusetts. Yeah, shout out to WSBK.
Is that right? Which movie is it?
Babes in Toyland.
Babes in Toyland. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
How did you feel about Laurel and Hardy being in there?
I actually liked it. It's the kind of scene I could see myself. I had to check myself. Am I liking this? I actually really liked it. I could see how one could object to the, you know, sort of found nature of this juxtaposition that the president takes in. But I liked it. I thought it really worked. First of all, I like Laurel and Hardy. I like that era. I like that kind of comedy. And I like the idea that an image from whatever 20s or 30s comedy could somehow not be the inciting incident, as he even explicitly says to Abby. It's not why he did anything, but that a chance clip of an old movie could be part of the stew in the president's mind that helps nudge him in a certain direction. I liked it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I didn't understand about this scene is what Abby says right beforehand. She says,
Tony's grandkids are in there watching a video.
Who's Tony?
No idea. I guess from West Side Story.
Is that Maria's love interest?
Indeed, Tony? Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
He died, but the grandkids, I guess, were adopted by a kindly family in New Hampshire. Well, yeah. Oof. It'll all be explained in the Spielberg West Side Story, I'm sure.
Okay. The Laurel and Hardy scene, I kept on being like, but who's Tony?
See, I actually just kept bumping on, like, the grandkids are watching Babes in Toyland, or it would have been, like, more like probably Toy Story 3 or something should have been playing. And the president should have sat down and said, this has no effect on anything I'm thinking about. But what are the odds that that's what they're watching?
Toy Story 3 was not out yet.
Okay, well, then it should have been Monsters, Inc. or whatever the hell was out then. You know, you get my point.
I watched Babes in Toyland.
Oh, I had one other thought about that scene, though. I think the other reason why that scene resonated for me was that President Bartlett struck me almost like a lovesick person. He's haunted and his heart is breaking about this whole situation, trying to decide whether mm-hmm. he's going to act or not. It's almost like when you've been broken up with and you're heartbroken and everything you hear on the radio, every song seems to be a song that
yep.
is germane somehow to your situation. It kind of felt that way to me. He sits down and what's yeah. playing? These, you know, Babes in Toyland and these wind-up soldiers. And I liked that aspect of it.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about in the last episode is a line that I really enjoyed, which was Charlie's line.
Well, I've got my own Beach Boys song going.
Yes.
That scene is slightly inflected with Trump ay-ay-ay, though, because just bringing up the idea of the president watching something on TV and then having it spark a reaction that then changes U.S. policy.
That didn't cross my mind.
We have to live with.
I didn't think about the dark underbelly of that scene.
Mm-hmm. I mean, someone had done the work of actually, I've seen tweets where people have shown side by side something that Trump had tweeted next to a headline or,
like,
know,
a Chiron
on the runner. Yeah, from Fox and Friends.
And the elapsed time between when he likely saw it and then tweeted about it.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Using the same wording. Yes, it's astonishing, not in a good way.
Yeah. So as much as it pains everyone to hear this, it does for me to say this. All right, let's a little Trump-esque here.
Never would have crossed my mind, but fair enough.
Then our band of heroes has their outing broken up because CJ finds out about this article. You know, Danny's article has come out and they've gotten screwed by it and they all have to rush back. They wake up Will, which is a great moment.
I enjoyed shooting that scene very much.
Oh yeah? Do you remember that day?
It's fun. Same thing would happen with Scandal on occasion. Anytime you didn't wear a suit on the West Wing, like, oh, something special is up. I'm in bed or I'm in underwear and a t-shirt. Or whatever. And just, it's fun to do also in a Sorkin project to do a scene that is very light on dialogue and that involves some physicality. So this is one of those things mm-hmm. where I remember, I think, instead of blocking it too specifically, Leslie decided to shoot it in a way where they could get whatever I did. We'd see the whole frame and that they would just then actually do what was being done to Will. They would buzz him, they'd call him, they'd call his personal phone and his buzzer and the hotel phone and just let it kind of unfold the way it would and try to answer each thing as it happened. And it was great fun to kind of do it spontaneously.
Right. That's great. It's not like the sounds were added in post.
Yeah, maybe they were sweetened or something like that, but it was all right. Really happening.
That's great. And then CJ confronts Danny as, you know, as they all come walking into the West Wing again. And I thought it was interesting that Danny admits that his paper did something unethical.
Sometimes people say something to a researcher because they think they're not on the record.
They're not on the record!
No.
Yeah, he's got no defense for him.
Yeah, this is a moment that we haven't had too often in the West Wing too, where there's just, you know, someone has done something unethical that is not, you know, necessarily politically motivated or anything like that. The Washington Post, which is, you know, Danny's writing is upheld as this like important endeavor all the time. But here they've screwed up, and as a result, they've screwed over the administration.
Yes. This is one of those cinematic situations that always frustrates me, although we don't have a long time of realizing that it's Donna and that she's brought it on herself. But when people are falsely accused,
yes,
it really bugs me. It's hard. I find
mistaken identity is my least favorite trope in storytelling.
Oh, really? See, I'm not even criticizing to me, it's very effective because it makes me crazy. Like I get very frustrated watching things where someone's taking blame for someone else, even if she has brought it on herself willingly the way Donna has. Like, it just, I don't know why, there's something in me that it's like my mom can't watch mess. She doesn't like to watch things where a house is incredibly messy. And I don't like mistaken identity. Now, you don't like it as a device itself, as a dramatic device.
Yeah, and I don't think that that's what's happening here. I think, this is not something that bothers me. What I don't like is mistaken identity when it results in somebody... Yeah, I don't like when someone gets blamed for something else and there's no way for them to remedy the injustice of it. I used to get really bothered by cartoons where there was, you know, like a sweet and cuddly character who would like make a mess and then turn back into like a sweet character, and everyone would think that it was the protagonist's fault and only the protagonist knew.
Oh yeah, so this is the same thing. We have a very similar response.
Yeah, it's the same reason why I can't watch Meet the Parents. It's too painful to me.
I don't get
any comedy from it.
I feel you, although I do think that movie's funny. And what of Jack Reese? Very unceremoniously written off the show.
Yeah, considering he has a ceremonial saber and everything.
Well said. Is there a story behind the story? Did Christian Slater want out? Did he get something else? Was he unavailable? I wonder.
Let me look up his IMDb here for a second. I mean, I can only speculate that if he really loved doing the show, then he probably would have made himself available for these episodes.
I would think so. Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I guess what I'm saying, if this is the sum total, and indeed it is, the sum total of Jack Reese, why'd they bring him on? You know, he was fine and he was good, I think. And there is something he brought to the show, and it was a little breath of fresh air and from a different point of view and a different job being done. It was interesting to watch. And then, you know, a little romantic frisson with Donna, and then nothing.
Yeah.
So I gotta believe the plan was for greater things.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big name to get.
Right.
And it's not even like Ainsley, where we know there was another opportunity and Ainsley was in several episodes. This is just three episodes and then he's gone. My feeling is that he was really there. His saber was there to provide a foil to Josh and Donna's romance.
So you could compare sabers.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
It was sort of an EPing contest.
Ooh, nice. I think if you showed Christian Slater, this is going to be your whole role, he would never have taken the role. So I don't know if it's just that this is, you know, the extent to which Aaron wanted to use this character or something didn't work out. I wonder. I feel like there's more of a story there. That being said, thanks to Jack Reese, we get the snowball throwing scene, which was also great fun to shoot.
That's a really great scene.
Oh, I was going to ask whether it was fun to watch. I like that scene just because it was so much fun to do.
I think it was probably more fun to make than it was to watch, but it's a nice scene in general. You know, I mean, the fun really comes from the dialogue more than the snowball action, but the idea of the guys all throwing snowballs at Donna's window is fun enough.
Yeah, it's always good fun. I can't speak to the first three seasons, but by the time I joined, we went to DC, I think in seasons 4, 5, and 6 anyway, twice maybe during a season, and we would shoot various things. This would be where Aaron would have to get, to the extent that he ever did, get ahead of himself a little bit, he and his writers, and figure out some exterior scenes to shoot that could be sprinkled throughout the season.
Oh, that's a real exterior scene in D.C.
Maybe I'm making it up. That's my memory.
It looks like such a set to
me. Oh, it does? That's funny. Well, maybe I'm completely wrong. Now I'll have to ask Eli or somebody. Because my memory is that that was on a D.C. Maryland trip.
Huh. I just assumed it was a set.
That's funny.
I had thought that, now to respond to something you raised 30 minutes ago, maybe the reason why Iota got a name check in the episode is because on one of the D.C. trips, maybe Aaron or people from the crew actually went to Iota.
That may be.
After shooting or something like that.
And it's possible I said, you know what, I'm going to go to sleep. Right. Also, an entirely credible storyline. Actually, that's not really true.
Yeah, you liked it. You stay out late.
Yeah. Josh and Donna, at this point, as much as I hate the phrase, get a room. I mean, now that it's just, they're completely, I mean, it's, there's no cat, there's no bag. They're in love with each other blatantly. I mean, this is, couldn't be a more romantic scene. They're essentially playing out Romeo and Juliet. I mean, come on, guys.
Well, that's why Jack Reese is there, to put some time in there, give a little, and I think he also gives some fuel to Josh's motivation. You know, Josh is now really, he's a mess. He's all over the place. He's actually acting irresponsibly because of his jealousy. He's taking it out on Donna. So I think that dramatically, at least, having this other character, giving them another kind of love triangle to work off of, helps delay something that they were hurtling towards a little too quickly.
I guess it delayed it for a couple episodes, but I mean, it's...
If it's supposed to be a will they, won't they.
Right, but...
And we all know it's...
It's more of a when they.
Right. Why won't they?
Yeah. And at this point, or you know, the hurdle has happened. You know, Jack Reese is now out of the picture and he's just staring at her and, you know, telling her how pretty she is. And they,
and then she's going to sit on his lap in the car.
Oh, there's also that too. Yes, indeed.
And then somehow the grossest part of it is that Josh says she has to call him Wild Thing.
Ay, vey Ismir. That I did a... Big old, my eyes almost rolled out of my head. And that's, of course, the kind of thing I'm sure people who love Josh Lyman and love Brad Whitford love that little bit. But it's horrendous.
Well,
it's vomitous.
The thing I liked most about the Wild Thing comment is I was wondering if it was an Intersheen reference.
Wow, wait, what? Oh, the baseball movie.
Maybe Josh Lyman is a fan of Major League, and he saw Charlie Sheen playing the character Wild Thing.
Look at you in your long
and
ball.
That's why he wants her to call him Wild Thing.
Perhaps so.
Could you imagine Charlie Sheen playing the character of Josh Lyman? For a second there, I could.
It would be certainly a different spin on it would have been, I guess-ish.
I don't know. Going backwards, I like that the president calls anyone... in America who hails from below the New Hampshire southern border, Southerners, including yes. People from Massachusetts. It reminded me of Game of Thrones and how the free folk call, you know, the people of the North Southerners.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And I thought, New Hampshire and the free folk both have the motto, live free or die. I mean, the free folk of Game of Thrones really are as close to a live free or die kind of people as there is.
Very good. I like that.
Also, I wanted to give a shout out to our listener, Michael, who sent us an email. He wrote, I noticed a mistake around the 28-minute mark. CJ says...
That's the U.S. Marine Corps band right there, Commandant's Own.
And Michael points out that the Marine band is known as the President's Own. The Commandant's Own is actually the Marine Drum and Bugle Corps, and the two are completely separate from one another, because that's not confusing.
No. Good eye, Michael.
One thing you want in military is as much ambiguity as possible.
Yes, that usually works well. Bartlett has a rough line when he talks about the likely response. President Roughline. The likely response to his now altered speech. And
yes.
I can't remember the buildup, but the capper is...
And the Arab world will just go indiscriminately crazy.
I was like, dude... You're on the eve of, or about to. He's going to give the speech. And it's a new doctrine for foreign policy. And then with this giant broad brush, he just comes out with that about the Arab world. How as one, they will react indiscriminately crazy. It's like, it's a rough one, dude. Like maybe temper your speech and your thought.
It's a bad look to go in this context in particular.
Right.
It is cute, though, that before he finishes addressing them, they all just start making their plan.
Mm-hmm. I do like that.
It's a nice let Bartlett be Bartlett moment.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we're now caught up with the timeline in terms of the very beginning of Inauguration Part 1, the first scene where Ed and Larry are talking to the president about the order of the balls, the inaugural balls, not the snowballs or the Spalding balls.
Very good. Nice ball work.
And this is a neat thing, and I want to know the answer to this. So the two parts of this episode were directed by two different people.
Oh, I had the same thought. I know what you're going to posit or question. Yeah.
The part one was directed by Christopher Misiano. And as you mentioned earlier in this episode, this one was directed by Leslie Linka-Glotter. But in both episodes, there's this shot of, or this, there's a scene rather of the president walking down the hall and having this discussion with Ed, Larry, and CJ. In part one, we stay with them. It continues. They keep talking about this. And here we go to that scene again, but it's been shot a second time. It's not just the footage from part one.
New angles.
Being replayed. Yeah. They've reshot it, and the camera now lets them pass by and then follows Toby. And so they had to shoot that scene a second time. And so I wonder, did they shoot that scene with two different directors and do it twice? Did they do them back to back for the sake of continuity? I'm just curious how that worked.
My assumption in watching it was that Christopher Misiano had directed and shot extra footage that was used in Leslie Linka-Glotter's episode. And maybe I have to go back and look if you're suggesting that it was more significant than I realized. I pondered the same thing, and I assumed it was looking ahead to the second part and thinking we'll want extra and different coverage that we'll use.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, especially since Chris Misiano is also one of the producers. He can sort of think ahead that in that way and say, okay, I'm doing this for my episode, but I'm also covering this for the next director's episode.
I mean, the expense of going back to reshoot a scene you've already done, and it doesn't seem likely to me that that's what they did, but yeah.
Yeah.
But it calls for the kind of planning that we've learned doesn't happen that often in the West Wing, so I think this isn't a situation where they had to plot out and think a little bit, have a little more foresight than perhaps generally they had the luxury of doing.
Yeah. But I really like that this scene, basically the two versions of the scene are practically different. They're very similar, but they actually shot it twice and then said, and this time we're going to have this camera fall, you know, it's going to trail off and the camera's going to go here. There's still no cut. You know, they stuck to the West Wing's commitment of these long shots and long takes. But it would have been very easy to do the same thing and just reuse the footage and then just cut to another place. But this is a really clever and subtle way because, you know, frankly, by the time you get to this part of the episode, where you're so far, especially if you're watching it the way that we're watching it and the way it originally aired, there's a week in between the two episodes and then...
They could have gotten away with a shortcut.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be fun to recut this episode. It would take away a lot of the art of it, but it would be really fun to see a cut of these two episodes told in chronological order.
Ah, like they did with Godfather Parts 1 and 2.
Exactly.
The Inauguration Day saga.
Yeah, exactly. I would like to watch that.
Interesting.
And then that would allow for the possibility of seeing these two scenes back to back. I tried to do something similar, but even just switching from one episode to the other, Netflix, it was hard to retain. They were so close that it was hard to retain the specific details.
That would be fascinating. Actually, that's a great idea. It would be interesting to do. Did I miss something, or is there a weird non sequitur to Charlie's suddenly invoking Zoe's name?
Charlie, who are you? I love Zoe and I must have her back.
What is he talking about? How does Zoe figure into the at the end where he keeps talking about getting back his lost love? And it seems to come out of nowhere, or am I forgetting something?
Well, he's been, you know, he's got his own Beach Boys song going on.
Right. I know it's obviously on his mind.
Yeah.
Why is he talking about it in the snowball scene?
I think there is a little bit of a jump that we aren't witness to where he goes from mild jealousy to like zealous fervor. He goes from jealous to zealous.
Nice. In this, there's a whole romantic adventure going on that he's part of. And is it like everybody's acknowledgement that Josh and Donna are in love and this is a romantic romp they're part of? They're just romantic wingmen, West Wingmen?
I think that, Charlie knows exactly what's going on because the Beach Boys line is in response to Josh mentioning Jack Reese. Josh says Jack Reese got transferred and Charlie says, I've got my own Beach Boys song going.
Yeah, so he knows what's what.
Yeah.
I think they all do, though.
He's just drafting on Josh and Donna's romance, trying to build up some momentum to take on Jean-Paul.
Fair enough.
as he may be good-looking and rich and well-schooled and French royalty, you know, and live basically in a castle, but... Oh, God, if this is what I've been telling you, get in the car.
I like that we haven't witnessed it, but that Toby's whole part in this thing has been to tell Charlie, this guy's better than you in all ways, so give it up. Thanks, Toby. It's a good antidote to the scene earlier where Toby tells Leo so sweetly how much he appreciates Will and wants to promote him. You know, just so you don't think things have gone crazy.
Right.
He comes back and he tells Charlie, this is what I've been telling you. Actually, my favorite part about the scene between Leo and Toby, when Toby says he wants to promote Will, is Leo's reaction to it. Leo's face, even after the conversation ends and Toby walks away, Leo is like beaming. He's so proud of Toby for having warm feelings towards another human being and then expressing them and wanting to do something tangible about them.
That is sweet.
Yeah. Oh, I had one other thought about Donnie's motel Bible.
Oh, okay.
It reminded me a little bit of Guns Not Butter. Like, I liked the idea that despite how in the past things have been, you know, inaugurations have been done with this gravitas and, you know, the ceremonial importance of which Bible to use and all this stuff. Going with Donnie's, the Bible from the motel, reminded me of Donna's line, the story that she tells Josh.
Oh, Lord, give me health and strength. We'll steal the rest.
Somebody stole that Bible from a motel and put it in the Library of Congress.
Oh, very good.
And when they needed it, they called on it.
I like that.
The fact that that quote starts with, oh, Lord, give me health and strength. We'll steal the rest. It just feels...
Good tie-in. Very good. Of a piece.
Here's a question. How does Danny know that Josh got a Fulbright scholarship and that he taped it to his forehead? Did you catch that line?
Yes. I just took that as an implied intimacy that we had not heretofore known, if that's English.
To me, it made it sound like they were saying that these guys knew each other in college.
Perhaps, yeah. They certainly seem to go way back. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't track.
But that doesn't fly because Josh went to Harvard and Danny Kincannon went to, do you remember?
God, no.
He went to Notre Dame.
Oh.
So I don't know how he knows what Josh did when he was a Fulbright scholar.
I just took it to mean they're better friends than we realized, but I don't know.
Yeah. I do like the bond that the two of them share, but maybe Amy Gardner told Danny about
it. Okay. Who's Amy Gardner? Just kidding.
Okay, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll speak to Gene Sperling.
And now, back to the show.
Joining us now to talk about this episode is Gene Sperling. Mr. Sperling, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me. The West Wing played a pretty big role in my life. It's where I met my wife, Allison Abner, so it's special to me in many ways.
I definitely want to ask you about that part of it.
Yeah.
But first, maybe let's talk about the story here in the two-part inauguration episode and how you contributed to what the plot is.
You know, I would say of my 4 years, this was the most meaningful because of the seriousness of the subject matter. But it happened when I was talking with a writer on the show named David Gerken, who I'd known from Washington, D.C. And on a particular day as we were batting around, I believe he had started to read Samantha Power's book on genocide. And I had just been reading about a recent evacuation of missionary children from some violence in Africa. And it led to the following story idea, which was that Bill Clinton always and still does feel his greatest regret in public service was that the United States government and the other Western governments did not move fast enough in Rwanda. And so we started asking, what would it be like to do a story the other way, where the United States had in fact intervened in a country where there was no real security interest, it was almost purely humanitarian. What would that discussion be like? What would the ramifications of people dying were? And so that was really the idea. And I will say that it's not often when you come up with story ideas that Aaron Sorkin would ever take anything precisely as you did it. But the one exception was we came up with the idea that, which was in the previous episode, that the president would be sitting with who we imagine to be Bishop Tutu.
Your Excellency, I got a very sketchy intelligence report on the violence in the Capitol about an hour ago.
The violence isn't limited to Bitanga, sir. It's spread to the countryside.
I didn't know that.
May I ask you something, sir, with all due respect, please?
Yes.
If mass genocide had broken out in a small European country, would your intelligence briefing this morning have been quite so sketchy?
No.
So I think I will always hold on to that as the one thing that Aaron Sorkin ever used, and that was rather precisely.
Straight from you, yeah.
But that really was the concept, which was to take on this very serious issue, you know, have the White House staffers debate the moral issues, and then imagine the fallout the other way if they did what I think most of us, including President Clinton, wish the United States had done.
Let's go back for a second, step away from the episode and go back to 1994 when the Rwandan genocide was actually taking place and your role in the Clinton administration. Do you remember that moment in your tenure when you were deputy director of the National Economic Council at that time, I think?
You know, I don't. The fact was, if you're on the domestic policy team, you really didn't have great insight. And look, the reality is that it all happened in about 90 days. And, you know, I think that the administration, you know, has done a good job of not pointing fingers at each other. But I think it's safe to say that President Clinton never quite felt that he had been brought up to speed with the degree of urgency that he would have wanted. This was not a case where 20 years later somebody regrets what they've done. This is a case of something that happened at horrifying speed, and when it was clear what had happened and the depth of the terror, there was almost instantaneous deep regret, at least from the president's level. And as you know, only a few years later, March 25th, 1998, he goes to Rwanda and apologizes, and that's actually when they also start the kind of early detection for genocides. I think that the fact that so much horror could happen at such blinding speed was a wake-up call to the global community that this is not something that could go through some of the normal, slower processes of foreign policy decision-making.
I was just going to ask whether there was a sense also that the Clinton administration was hesitant after what had happened in Somalia in a few years earlier in the Battle of Mogadishu in terms of acting.
I think in his heart of hearts, President Clinton probably thinks that there was a certain number of people felt they were protecting him, that this was that the so-called Black Hawk Down had been an example of what it looked like when you went into these very difficult situations that had been very difficult. This was just a year later. So I think that in some ways that likely contributed throughout the level. But again, I don't want to play a foreign policy expert, particularly at that time. I was the deputy just for domestic policy. But it had a deep scarring effect on President Clinton. I think it's probably safe to say that his aggressiveness, almost United States solo aggressiveness in Bosnia later, was no doubt motivated by him not wanting to be part of letting something like this happen a second time.
There's one moment in the episode where CJ is in the briefing room.
The problem is the convention distinguishes between acts of genocide and genocide.
It distinguishes between acts of genocide and genocide?
It does. Mark.
How many acts of genocide constitute a genocide?
I don't know.
I think this is also taken directly from an experience within the Clinton administration that in June of 1994, that spokespeople from the administration were also told to represent it as acts of genocide as opposed to genocide.
No, that was definitely one of the things that I contributed in. And, you know, I was very lucky to help develop that story, but I was often in a consultant role. And so a lot of times what you were doing was feeding kind of interesting notes that you knew would have dramatic effect. And I think I described, it was a rather infamous State Department briefing, which again, happened years later under the Bush administration, almost exactly where the spokesperson is going to, you know, whether it's acts of genocide or genocide. It's interesting that when Clinton goes to Rwanda in 1998. He specifically refers to that. He says, we did not act quickly enough once the killing began. We should have not allowed the refugee camps to become safe havens for the killers, and we did not immediately call these crimes by their rightful name, genocide. So that was actually part of his apology in 1998. And so that was definitely a case where CJ is very much living out something that at least the State Department spokesperson had done in June of 1994. In President Clinton's view, he almost immediately, upon realizing the depth of the terror, regretted it, and in fact tried to really figure out if the Western countries had acted quicker in the United States supporting the peacekeeping mission, how much of the killing could have been prevented. And, you know, his belief is a third, which is not a small amount. That could have been as many as 300,000 people. So this was very serious.
There is another little mention in this episode to an echo from the Clinton administration.
I don't know if this is true. I heard once that you convinced the president to let you rewrite a section of the State of the Union with less than 24 hours to go. It was the second year, and everybody was a Republican, whether they were or not. And people at the DNC had convinced him to include the line, the era of big government is over, and you couldn't live with it.
Yes, I think that I probably, for better or worse, was responsible for giving them a bit of insight into that. No, there was President Clinton had, as I think Michael Waldman and others, who is one of the president's chief speechwriters, has chronicled, the initial line was, the era of big government is over, but so shall be the era of every man for himself. And in one of those regrettable notions, there was an objection to saying every man for himself. And actually, in the TV show, they mention mankind.
CJ says there are three references to mankind. Can we make it humankind?
Yeah.
And I think there were people who regretted that we didn't fix that problem that way, and that instead the line famously became,
the era of big government is over.
And obviously, President Clinton believed very deeply in the role of government. But he was responding to the fact that the country had turned against him in the 94 election. But it did seem to spark Aaron putting in a moment where, when they're doing the fact check, someone says, can we change mankind to humankind? And maybe that was Aaron's way, after hearing the story, of saying, why didn't they just keep the line in and say every human for themselves?
But it didn't, isn't there still, in the actual State of the Union, in Clinton's 96 State of the Union, isn't there a second line that says something about not going back to every citizen having to fend, or citizens having to fend for themselves? I feel like there is a second, strangely less famous line that does temper what he had to say.
You know, listen, I obviously think that people are, you know, are a little rough on the president on that one line. There's no question his overall State of the Union even then was a defense of government. And, you know, he ends up essentially saving his presidency by saving the social safety net in what for many of us who worked with him thought was his finest moment. Because really what happened at the end was that there started to look like there could be a deal worked out where we would win on Medicare, but we would allow Medicaid to be block grant and cut deeply. Mm-hmm. And he famously says in that final meeting where I was in the cabinet room as it happened, he tells Dick Armey, if you want to have your Medicaid policy, he points to Bob Dole, you better put somebody else in my chair. I don't care if it all comes down around me. I don't care if I go to 5% in the polls. I'm not taking your Medicaid budget. So, you know, it was a tough year. The country had gone very conservative. You know, we'd lost both the House and the Senate. You know, that line, you know, would have been better cushioned by a more memorable line that, as you say, might have been in there, but just wasn't done tightly and strongly enough that it was remembered as cushioning the era of big government is over line.
Right. It doesn't sit with it as part of the soundbite.
No, but I think Josh is right that he did very clearly made clear there that, you know, still a very strong belief in an activist government, and says so strongly within that speech But, you know, you live and die by your sound bites, and that sound bite right. stuck alone.
Well, this also, it all goes to, you know, one of Aaron's great themes, which language matters. That's such a West Wing focus in his writing.
No, and there's no question. Both him and President Obama spent an enormous amount of time on their State of the Union and worked very hard. And that was one of the things that Aaron, you know, really wanted me to brief all the writers about, was just the whole process, how long it took, the pizza boxes and the all-nighters and the back and forth and the type of debate that went on. And I think you do get a glimpse of that in this episode. You know, it comes down around Kundu and foreign policy. But the reality is that these speeches are an action-forcing event, and they do force presidents to figure out what their priorities are. Later in 1998, President Clinton used a single line that worked greatly to his advantage. A surplus was building up, which should have been good news, except with an all-Republican Congress, there was growing momentum that they were going to take the surplus and give it all in a tax cut to very well-off Americans. And President Clinton kind of went out there and he said, you know, we have a big Social Security problem, and so we should save Social Security first. And I was part of writing that first line. And believe me, I was not as eloquent as Bill Clinton or Aaron Sorkin. And President Clinton shortened it down to just save Social Security first. And Gingrich didn't know what to do, so he stood up. And then they all stood up. And that was a moment where a State of the Union made policy. Suddenly the Republicans seemed to have agreed that we shouldn't use the surplus for tax cuts until Social Security was fixed. Now, they tried to back out of it later, but that was a moment where capturing that one sentence just right had kind of a big impact on policy in those last couple of years of the Clinton White House.
Were you there at the joint session when he said that? Did you get to witness that in person?
Oh, yes. I was at all eight of the States of the Union.
Stepping away from the episode a little bit, can you tell us about how you met Allison Abner through the show?
So the story starts that, of course, we all of us West Wing actual people were smitten with the show The West Wing. I had actually talked with Tom Schlamme and a few of the other people when they toured The West Wing on a Sunday before the show had been on the air. I didn't think much of it at the time, but we were absolutely fascinated with this show that was basically seemed to be trying to emulate our lives. Though, as I always said, we didn't walk as fast, we weren't as funny, and we weren't as good looking. But other than that, it was not too far.
Except for when I joined the cast. I helped close the gap.
No. Bill Clinton invited some of the actors, I think the whole cast, to the State of the Union party for his final State of the Union. And that day I met Brad Whitford and Dulé Hill and Richard Schiff and John Spencer, many others. Dulé and Brad probably stayed in most contact with me. And Brad is so into politics and policy that he would constantly be sending me policy ideas, which made me think that if Brad was sending me policy ideas, this opened up the possibility that I could send him an idea for a show.
Fair enough.
So sure enough, I worked very hard on a story that was one of the main stories that they took and actually was one of the main stories in the episode Arctic Radar. It was about whether there was hypocrisy in us allowing a top woman military person to be discharged for having an affair with a male subordinate when obviously that had happened so many times in reverse without such consequences. In any case, when I pitched that idea to Brad, he showed it to Tom Schlamme, and they invited me to interview to be a consultant. So the day that I arrived for my interview, I got a call just as I was coming in saying that Aaron Sorkin could not meet with me, which I found a little disappointing as I'd flown from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. Sure. But they quickly informed me that it wasn't his fault. They said, do not worry. We have arranged a good day for you still, and you're going to meet the writers in the commissary at Warner Brothers. And I walked in there. It was very exciting. I kept seeing actors from the TV show ER. And sure enough, there was a table with a group of people around it. And I sat down there, and Brad was on my right. And I introduced myself to the writer on the left, and that was Allison Abner. And that was the first time I laid eyes on my wife.
And how soon after did you start working for the show?
I was signed up fairly quickly. They were energized to make it work, both because they'd like the story I put forward. Also, Lawrence O'Donnell was now leaving to do his show, Mr. Sterling. So I think they were looking to get a little stronger on the Washington side. So I joined right away. You know, I was very enthused about it. And they worked out a contract with me where I'd be a consultant, but where I would have a chance to be a contributing writer as well. And so I spent a lot of time. Allison and I had to decide when to let people know about our situation. At our wedding, Kevin Falls, who ran the writer's room, gave a toast at one point, claiming that he was the first to know when Allison had insisted that she had to talk to me on a very intricate foreign policy story for the show. And Kevin kept saying to her, well, you know, Allison, Gene's a really good guy, but I'm pretty sure he knows nothing about that area of foreign policy. And she said when Allison kept arguing that she thought it would be very important for us to talk together, he felt like that was his first clue. So, yes, I think the last time I saw Aaron Sorkin, he asked me about Allison. He said, well, he says there's two really, you know, great lasting things about our show. He said, residuals and your marriage.
That's fantastic.
That's wonderful.
Is there more about this episode that we haven't asked you about that we ought to be asking you about?
What I appreciate so much about The West Wing, and I think why it had such a positive impact on people, was not that it showed staffers or a president who were flawless, who didn't make mistakes, or who were never political. But I think you saw the heaviness that weighed on people, the sense of responsibility. And so what I appreciated so much about this episode is that you see, you know, whether it's in Josh's character, Will, coming in, or, you know, Toby, John Spencer, you see the heaviness, you know, weighing this big moral issue, weighing the fact that American young men and women will die if you do that. I feel that I can't speak for this White House, but I think in previous White Houses, the people I've known, Democrat or Republican, at least before this one, all went in with that sense of seriousness and responsibility. And you see it in Josh's Will Bailey character, and it's one I have felt quite often, which is when your conscience is telling you you must speak out, and you already have once or twice, but there's still a third or fourth time. And when does that speaking out on your individual conscience start to impede the ability of a core group of people to work together if you're constantly raising the issues? And there's no real right answer. If everybody fights for their cause till the very end and never accepts where the president's going, then you can't function. On the other hand, it can be hard to live with yourself if you feel like you had one more shot to maybe turn a decision the right way and you didn't take it. And I think you see that in Will Bailey's character. He's fighting for his conscience, but he's on the verge of being so uncooperative that he's not going to get asked back. And part of the nice part about this is that in the end of the day, Bartlett recognizes that that's a virtue about him, that he wants people who are going to speak their heart and speak their mind.
Oh, well said.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for your contributions to the podcast and for your contributions to the West Wing in general and to these two really inspiring episodes in particular.
Yeah, and not bad on the economic council work as well. That was pretty good, too.
Thanks. And I do want to make sure that my co-writer, David Gerken, gets the full shout out, because we did pitch this story together, and we both share the story credit, and we were partners through and through on the Kundu story.
For sure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gene, so much. This was great.
All right. Take care.
And that's our show. Another one in the can, Rishi.
True. Marching ever closer to the grave.
Wow. Bring me down. Buzzkill. But you can follow us, as we've told you before. And why don't you? I don't see our numbers exploding. Follow us. Do it this time. Follow me on Twitter. Follow Rishi on Twitter. Follow the show.
I get a little sad about the fact that the West Wing Weekly has more followers than I do.
That doesn't seem right.
You follow the West Wing Weekly, but you don't like the show enough to follow both of its hosts.
Come on, three clicks, people. Three clicks, do it. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. Between now and the release of next episode, you can listen to Rishi's other award-winning podcast, Song Exploder. You can catch me on Scandal, ABC, 9 o'clock, 8 central. And what else can you do? You can follow Gene Sperling.
Gene Sperling is on Twitter at Gene B. Sperling. It's true. Gene, always be Sperling.
So true. The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia, a curated collection of extraordinary cutting-edge podcasts. You can check out all the great offerings at radiotopia.fm.
And if you're in a following mood because of Josh chiding you two, you can follow Radiotopia at Radiotopia.
Yeah, that would be a total of five clicks if you want to include Gene and Radiotopia. But do the first three anyway.
Thanks to Margaret. Thanks to Zach.
Of course.
And thanks to you, Josh.
Thank you too, Rishi. Is this a new thing?
I don't know. Okay. Do you like it?
Nope.
Then yes, it is.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.